Today we have a special guest. It's one of our great digital health leaders out in the industry. He's worked all over the place. He's an entrepreneur, senior executive. He is absolutely one of the most passionate people for care collaboration and interoperability in healthcare. Even if you're having a social conversation with him, I know you're going to end up in that subject matter. So he's worked at the CMS Innovation Center. He's a frequent public speaker on these subjects. He's considered an absolute thought leader in value-based care. He has a caring and patient-first approach to his business. I've personally spent time in his offices with him and his team. He's dedicated to helping organizations across the country during these difficult times. It is with a great passion that he serves this nation through his company. He's a dear friend of Chime's, an amazing thought leader to our Chime Foundation. It is our pleasure to welcome Jay Desai, CEO and founder of Patient Ping. Welcome to the program, Jay.
Thank you so much, Russ. That was very generous.
So how are things going for you, your family, you know, the group over at Patient Ping, which I miss seeing your offices. Y'all have some pretty cool office space in Boston. So how are things going just personally at this time during these tough times?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking. Things are going well, as well as they could. We as a company shifted to work from home, or we were early in the shift to work from home, and it's been 5 months now, and we're in our fifth month with work from home, and the team has adjusted extremely well, given all of the challenges and complexity with, accommodating kind of work and life in between. So the team's done really well. And we're sort of operating in this, you know, kind of remote model for 5 months now. It's worked okay. Personally, I'm doing great. I've taken advantage of this time to try to live in different parts of the country, and happen to be in the West Coast right now and got my first COVID test yesterday, which was negative, thankfully. And it was neat. I was actually in the backseat of a Lyft through the whole thing. The Lyft kind of went through the testing station. I got, you know, kind of the nose swab, and it was probably 30 seconds start to finish, just from, and then the Lyft brought me back home. So it was pretty nice.
Wow, what an interesting story. You should have like recorded the whole thing on YouTube. You could have been a YouTube star through Lyft. Wow. Hey, so let's talk about you for just a little bit. You've worked in the federal government. You've been an entrepreneur in different places, but now you're running your own gig at Patient Ping. So tell us a little bit about your journey of how you got to this spot as CEO and co-founder of Patient Ping.
Yeah, you know, so I was working at Medicare at the CMS Innovation Center prior to starting Patient Ping, and was really part of an extraordinary team making this shift to value-based care from fee-for-service. So I helped design a lot of the new payment models, things like ACOs, bundled payments. At the time, they were quite new. This was in 2010, 2011. And, kind of helped put those programs out there. And, you know, I think the thing that I've learned in my journey as an entrepreneur is just to really, really obsess over the problem that you're trying to solve. And, you know, in my role at Medicare, it was working really hard to empathize with the challenges of provider groups that were trying to do the work of coordinating care. A big part of value-based care is to provide the right incentives for providers to engage in the really hard work of coordinating care. And, you know, that's as mundane as some of the tasks of care coordination may sound, things like, you know, following up after the patient gets discharged to make sure that home care gets set up, or making sure they get to a high quality skilled nursing facility, or reconciling their meds. It's really important work. And for me, building the processes, the systems, the tools that they needed from my role at Medicare was something that I spent a lot of time working with the ACOs to try to figure out. And one of these problems of, boy, you know, we're taking this accountability for these patients, and they get care all over the place. If I'm a physician group in, you know, the New England, in New England, and my patient goes to, you know, a lot of times they go to the hospitals in my neighboring region, but sometimes they're snowbirds and they may go to Florida half the year and get hospitalized down there, and then they may go to a nursing home for the recovery, you know, in Florida. And, you know, the ACOs were telling us that Medicare, we have no idea about it. We don't even know that it happened. You give us the claims, it's going to happen 90 days later. And they've already gone through the ER, they've gone through the hospital, they've had their post-acute care episode, and now we find out about it after the fact. Well, how are we supposed to do the work of coordinating the care if we didn't know about it? And, you know, I just kept hearing that problem over and over again and just really became very fascinated in it. And, you know, when you're talking about one group of providers trying to get information from another group of providers so that they can coordinate the care, that then brought me to this space of interoperability. Frankly, I had no idea about interoperability or health IT or, you know, tech. I didn't come from that world, but I was thinking really hard about the problem. And after understanding and empathizing with the concerns of these provider groups that were trying to coordinate care, it just naturally brought me to this solution, which is, you know, a network to notify providers when their patients get care. And then patient pain was born out of that.
So as you get a unique view of at least the United States and your work with so many different metropolitan areas, healthcare organizations, HIEs, all these different companies you work with, kind of give us what you think's occurring from this COVID across the country, kind of what's your view? You're normally based in Boston, but now you're all the way across to the other side of the country. Kind of give us just some of your personal perspectives on how this is going or not going.
Yeah, so, boy, this is a complicated issue, and I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on, you know, many, many parts of this issue. There is one area where we do have a pretty good perspective, which is how the care delivery system is doing their best to respond to the needs of patients, you know, who are both infected and uninfected, who still have needs to consume healthcare services. And seeing kind of the fundamental kind of shift because of this, you know, gyration that, you know, this virus is putting, you know, is sort of knocking through, you know, the provider's landscape, as well as the, you know, the way that patients are consuming care has been wild. You know, several components of it. I would say hospitals and ERs and, you know, trying to figure out ways to be more responsive. I think in the early days of them, you know, completely stopping elective procedures, dealing with these huge holes on their income statement and their balance sheets now as a result of the revenue not coming in from a business perspective, but also worrying about the patients who need that care. And trying to find alternatives for them for certain chronic procedures or new diagnoses of cancer. That's been fascinating to watch. And I think health systems were doing everything they possibly could to both stay afloat, take care of the patients who needed it desperately during the height of the pandemic, while also still creating the space to be able to do the work for the patients who still needed healthcare that weren't COVID patients. And I've seen, you know, leadership in ways that I've never seen by health system executives across the country. It's been truly inspiring to watch. I think on the primary care side, it's, you know, the clinics are empty. And I think they're still largely empty. And people are afraid to go to the doctor's office because, you know, who knows? It's an infection-rich environment. And if somebody else has COVID there, you know, sit in the waiting room, you don't want to, you know, you want to expose yourself. So you'll just stay home. And that brought birth, obviously, to the telehealth industry, and that the pace of growth of the telehealth industry has just been staggering. You know, I look at statistics, and you know, the percentage of visits that are telehealth, you know, pre-COVID and post-COVID are, you know, these are numbers that nobody in their wildest dreams could have contemplated this kind of growth, especially after the telehealth industry has been trying to drive adoption for years. So that's been fascinating to observe as well. And then I think at the analytics layer, the infrastructure, boy, the you know, HHS sort of building their own surveillance system to replace the one that the CDC had based on years of syndromic surveillance efforts that were beginning built. I think that's been another very interesting dynamic that I think, you know, our country does have pretty good surveillance infrastructure. I think it can be better. But it, you know, I would say it's been somewhat surprising to see that the syndromic surveillance infrastructure that we built over the decades is not being leveraged in the way that it can be, and instead we're sort of building an entirely new system. That's just honestly been surprising and a little bit confusing, honestly, why we're not using what we already have as infrastructure for this country. So, you know, I could go into a lot of other dimensions, but overall, I would say that, you know, it sort of shows the resiliency and the grit of Americans to be able to be so responsive from a healthcare delivery perspective to the patients who need it.
So let's get down to the foundation of what you do and what Patient Ping does well. And that's information sharing, ensure the right information's there. First, and this can be kind of a two-part question for you to answer at once. One, why is it just so darn hard in this country to share information ubiquitously across this nation? And second of all, what have you all done to make especially the ADT portion of that, the admission, discharge, and transfer process to improve care coordination a little bit easier for everybody, or maybe in your case, a lot easier for everybody?
Yeah. So I think the broader question on why is it that when I go from one doctor to the next, I have to start all over again with them knowing my medications and my medical history and my vaccines and allergies. Why doesn't that information just flow? And I think, you know, it's obviously a very complicated set of dynamics that would answer why that isn't the case today in you know, such a modern country, where, you know, the idea of information moving from one system to the other is a, you know, is a solved technology problem, you know, decades long solved technology problem that's been, you know, done in many other industries of, you know, information moving between databases. I think it's part technology, it's part standards, you know, making it cheaper for systems to talk to each other through APIs. And but I would say the bigger issue has always been incentives, you know. And if I'm, you know, I'll just give you an example of our law firm. You know, they have an interest to make it really hard for me to switch law firms. And so they got all of our files, and for us to, you know, go to another law firm, it's a big pain in the butt to get all of those files and then move them to another law firm and then get them up to speed on what's going on with our company. And so it's not that different for a hospital when you've got a fee-for-service system with a lot of competition between health systems, and you know, they want you to be very much enveloped within that health system as long as your medical records are there, and you know, they're sort of warehoused within that system. It's hard for you to go somewhere else for your care. And that's in the interest of that particular health system to make it hard. And you know, despite the best efforts and intentions of the clinical community, it doesn't necessarily work as well for their business when you can just have full interoperability to go from one place to the next. So I think it's historically been a problem of incentives. Value-based care creates an incentive now to actually do the opposite, which is make sure the information is flowing, because you're incentivized to keep people out of the hospital, to give them the right care at the right time before they have something bad happen to them. And then when something bad does happen to them, make sure you're coordinating with everybody else out there to get them recovered and healed and, you know, at home quickly. So I think, you know, so if you were to ask me what the reason is that we have not had good interoperability of broad healthcare data, I think it's if I was to point to the principal issue, of which there are, you know, there are many, I would point to the incentives. On ADTs, you know, this is a good example. I would say, you know, ADTs, you know, electronic notifications, meaning I want to know where my patient is. This is a good example of a non-controversial and benign data sharing, you know, agreement, basically, between two or more health systems and other providers within the community to say, all right, look, we know my patients are going to your hospital and you know your patients are coming to my hospital. And we're doing some of this value-based care stuff. We're doing some of this population health stuff. And honestly, I don't want you to know everything about what's going on with your patients at my hospital. And you know, you don't want to tell me everything about what's going on with those same patients at my hospital. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, we compete, we contract with payers, we have certain scale advantages, and, you know, we explore mergers and acquisitions within our region. And so, like, you know, there's some competitive information as it relates to our finances as a health system. And I think, but ADTs, I guess we're okay with that. I guess we're okay with just notifying you of these encounters. It's probably, you know, once they're in my ER, you know, I don't think you're going to be able to send an ambulance and take the patient and bring them back to your hospital and, you know, and steal the patient, if you will, to use kind of an unduly crass description, which I've heard used by many folks out there in the clinical and you know, kind of health management community. You know, so okay, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with ADT data sharing. If we're going to do this value-based care stuff, we probably need to start notifying each other of the admissions. But if we talk about deeper data sharing, I'm not there yet. So, you know, I think we as a company, you know, and prior to starting this company when I was at Medicare, it was clear that it was non-controversial enough where, you know, where health systems would be okay sharing it, but they would resist. So it wasn't going to be a slam dunk. But if you create kind of, you know, quid pro quo arrangements, like I'll give if you, you know, give to get sort of relationships, like I'll give you my data if I'm allowed to get your data, you know, you can sort of break some of these stalemates that exist within a region. You get state pressure, you get payer pressure, and that gets things going. Now, Medicare picked up on this, which is a wonderful thing recently, where they saw, you know, there are still some markets where if a primary care provider goes to a hospital and says, I need to know when my patients leave your hospital so that I can do the work of managing their care transition and preventing them from going back to your hospital because we don't want them to get readmitted. There are still some hospitals that say, you know what? I got my own primary care doctors. I got my own ACO, and I don't really want to tell you about that. And Medicare said, no way. Like, we're not going to allow that to happen anymore. So they made it a condition of participation to say that this data has to be shared. It needs to be shared across the various provider communities that have an interest in tracking that discharge or admission to the hospital or presentation in the emergency room, which I think is a good thing to accelerate this, you know, again, non-controversial, generally benign set of interoperability, or a use case for interoperability that I think is getting broad adoption now across the country.
Well, that's probably a great transition to, as you mentioned, this condition of participation that came out of CMS. It was part of the interoperability and patient access final rule. Why don't you give us a little bit of an overview of that, some of the timelines that are there. I know in the CIO community, we're affectionately referring to it as the information blocker rule. So there's probably some demystifying there that we can do as well. We'd love to hear kind of your perspective of what this rule really means for not only tactical things that need to get done, but maybe even a little bit larger picture of the outcomes that are intended.
Yep. So in the broad interoperability package that got released in March, right before the pandemic really started escalating, you know, really a week before, I think the NBA canceled the season was the beginning of a lot of this, you know, kind of the shutdown. And this was, you know, around a week before that the interoperability package got released. There were two big components. There are two big components of the interoperability package. One is administered by CMS, one is administered by ONC. You know, the ONC rule is the Cures Act, the CMS is the Patient Access and Interoperability Rule. And, you know, combined, they do a lot to really make a big difference in how patient care is going to be delivered in this country. And so the ONC rule is probably more explicitly the info blocking rule. The CMS rule has a number of components to it. Info blocking isn't explicitly one of them, but there's a number of components that fall within the broad category of, you know, making data available and more interoperable. So let me kind of simplify the point in that there's two big rules. Under the Medicare rule, there's a number of components, But one of those components is the condition of participation for electronic notifications. So it's a big role. CIOs are faced with a lot of burden and question around APIs and making their data available to the vendor community, a number of other kind of electronic message email address, electronic contact information needs to get loaded to certain databases. There's sort of a number of provisions within both packages, but under the CMS rule, one specific component is the Medicare condition of participation for electronic notifications. That is the reason it's important and a big deal is because it's a condition of participation. So Medicare has many conditions of participation that hospitals are, have to deal with, things like you have to put up hand washing signs, in certain parts of your hospital, you need to have certain frequency of changing, gowns. And so it's typically around patient safety that they have conditions of participation. They said, if you want to get reimbursed on Medicare, we need you to do these things. So they added a condition of participation, which is a very big regulatory hammer, because basically it says that if you don't do the condition of participation, we'll put you on a corrective action plan. And if you continue to violate the condition of participation, then you run the risk of not being able to participate in Medicare. And for hospitals, obviously, that's a huge source of income for hospitals. And it would be untenable to not be a Medicare participant. That's why the COP is important. COP stands for condition of participation. And the specific rule says if a patient, you now have a requirement as a hospital to notify primary care groups and post-acute care groups when one of their patients presents in your ED, gets admitted to your hospital, gets discharged from your hospital. That's the high level. It just says when somebody shows up in your hospital, there's groups out there in the community that want to know about it, you need to tell them. That's kind of the broad provisions of it. And there's a number of details within the rule got finalized and posted to the Federal Register in May 1st of 2020. There's a 12-month implementation timeline, so that would put it at April 31st of 2021. April 30th of 2021 when the rule, the implementation date is final. So CIOs need to demonstrate capabilities and make a reasonable effort to share information with the provider community, ADT information with the provider community that wants to know about it. So that's it at a high level, Russ.
So why is part of this then, is there's this branding that it's, you may end up being an information blocker. What is the mystique around those words that none of us, by the way, want on our resume? There's mm-hmm. probably nothing about that sounds like a good experience for us. What's the key to that portion of the rule?
So the info blocking rule, as it's sort of colloquially referred to, is primarily focused on hospitals not hoarding the valuable electronic information that sits within their EHRs to the vendors that would be able to make use of that information for better patient care. That's what the info blocking, so they're saying you need to have APIs to make that data available to the vendors that want to make use of it to facilitate innovation and the broader community. That's different from the condition of participation. It has a similar connotation to it in that, they're saying if a provider within your community wants to know about an admission or discharge at your hospital, you need to make it available to them. They don't go so far as saying, if you don't, you're an info blocker. In this case, they say, if you don't, you are violating the condition of participation, which puts you at risk for the CMS, corrective action plan. But because it's kind of in the same vein, of like, we want you as a hospital to share this information so that patient care is better. And if you don't, you're kind of blocking that information from getting shared. It gets grouped into the same umbrella. So, to get really technical, the info blocking rule tends to apply to the API access for you know, for vendors that want to get access to the EHI, the electronic health information, or, but that's different from the ADT notifications flowing to the providers that want to know about it. Does that make sense? It's a little bit technical, but it's, and it makes very, very logical sense why they would all get grouped together. But they're actually separate provisions.
No, that's a great explanation. Greatly appreciated. So let's talk about then the next 9 months, despite the fact that we have no idea what's going to happen in the world of COVID. Some days it looks like it's getting better. Some days it looks like it's getting worse. But yeah. We kind of have about 9 months right around that time to be compliant with that condition of participation. So you're a CIO sitting in a hospital health system right now. You know, you've just gotten through this period now of, you know, I've got work I need to get done to be compliant by May of next year. How would you approach this? What would be your tactics for saying I need to address this issue?
So I would, it's a lengthy piece of regulation. And so what I would do is break it into its parts. To simplify the parts, there's two fundamental components that CIOs ought to think through capabilities to deliver the electronic notifications. One is, let's refer to it as patient identified notification. So patient shows up in your hospital and they say, my doctor is Dr. Branzell. And then at that point, the registrar will enter in the doctor's information. Your EHR will then look up the patient's, the doctor's email address. And there's actually a separate provision that requires doctors to update their electronic contact information. That was what I was referring to very inarticulately earlier. So you have to get that contact information and then send a message to them. Okay, so that kind of places the burden on the patient to name their doctor. They may have dementia. They may not remember the name of their doctor in that moment. They may name their cardiologist. They may name their lung transplant doctor. You know, so they may not name their primary care doctor. But regardless, whoever the doctor is that the patient names, the hospital needs to figure out a system to make sure that the alert goes through to that doctor. So that's patient identified notifications. The other capability that I think if you're a CIO, you need to think through is, okay, so we get that we're going to send the data to the, you know, to the doctor that the patient names, but there's these groups of providers that exist within my community that have their attribution lists. They've got their lists of patients that we know they want notifications on. And so let's say it's an ACO in your community, or really an ACO at a competitor health system within your region. Or let's say it's a home health agency that's got a list of patients that they're actively delivering home care to, or an FQHC, or a pop-up COVID transfer clinic. They have lists of patients that they want to know when they show up in your hospital or in your ER. And they're gonna come to you, the CIO, they're gonna come to the hospital and say, hey, we've got this list of patients. Can you tell us if any one of them has an encounter at your hospital? Now, to do that as a CIO, you have to ingest that roster, compare it against all the ADT messages that are being generated, do a match at a patient level, and then send a notification to the directed endpoint that group has an interest in knowing about. So both capabilities are really important here. And, you know, hospitals are going to get requested notifications from a wide range of providers. They may already have been getting requested based on those attribution lists. And so, you know, I would, as a CIO, I would think about how am I going to facilitate both capabilities? The first capability, we you know, patient being has spoken to virtually all the EHRs, you know, out there, and some have the capability to deliver the direct message based on, you know, the patient's named provider. And if they don't have it, some of them are working on, we at least are understanding that they are working on developing the capabilities. Some EHRs don't have the capabilities, but there is a mechanism to do that. And there are intermediaries that can take the ADT message, pull out the provider information name, look up the email address of that patient, of that doctor, and then send a message through. The other side of it of being able to ingest an attribution file or a patient roster and compare that against all the ADT messages at a patient level, and then send the notification through to the population health manager or the care coordinator. That's another capability that can be handled by an intermediary, or the hospital can insource it and figure out a way to manage all of those requests. There may be a large volume of requests that come through, so many hospitals may work with an intermediary there, but again, it's up to the hospital CIO to decide how they're gonna manage those requests that come.
So let's just hypothetically play this out. There's lots of different ways, you know, you might actually get to the end game here. Some, as you said, their EHR vendor can help them. Maybe a local HIE can help them. That doesn't necessarily help them on a grand scale, especially if, as you mentioned, they've got patient movements across a large geography, especially those that are snowbirders. So they come to you and say, we need help with this, Jay. Jay, help us get this thing done. We've got so many things on our plate. What do you do to help them?
So patient ping, our capabilities, would fully outsource this. So, you know, you would send an ADT message to patient ping. We can handle the patient identified side of it. We can handle the roster management side of it, where if somebody comes and requests it, you know, we will take care of it all on the back end. I don't want to make this all about patient ping. Obviously, there's a number of other groups that can offer those capabilities. The thing that's important for the hospital to think about, though, is working with a partner that can handle requests from a wide range of participants. One thing that's really important to think about is the types of attribution files that you'll get as a hospital will vary pretty broadly. So, you know, a ACO is going to get a list based on who the payer has attributed to that provider. And then, you know, that doesn't get updated that frequently. It could be once a month, it could be once a quarter. But other groups, like a nursing home that wants to know about their discharge patients showing back up at the ER, that's a constantly updated list. So really what you'd be doing is comparing a nursing home's discharge message, you know, which would be extended for some period of time, against your hospital ADT message, and then generating a notification based on that. And that's a little bit more complicated. So, you know, patient ping makes all that very easy. We fully outsource it. All you have to do is send an ADT feed to us, and then we take care of everything. So it's just an option, I think, that CIOs can consider.
Absolutely. So we obviously in a crazy time, Jay, you get to talk to a lot of people across a lot of our healthcare ecosystem. And so not just this rule that's so critically important to free up information flow, kind of at a macro level, what do you think the next 18 months of healthcare looks like in this country right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the industry, you know, dealing with a public health crisis at this scale is something that I don't think we've ever dealt with as a globe, as a world. And I think that it's going to take a while for us to really build the types of workflows and organizational scaffolding to handle the type of complexity that comes with both dealing with the patients who have this, you know, very contagious virus, while still maintaining operations for everybody else. I think that this is such a radical transformation of how we deliver care, keeping people out of the hospital because of not just, you know, some of the value-based care incentives or readmissions, but really fear, for hospital-acquired infections. You know, we used to use this word hospital-acquired infections at Medicare as a major initiative. When I was there, it was hospital-acquired infections and readmissions. Those were the two big quality improvement opportunities there. And to think about hospital-acquired infections in this context with COVID, it's just a much bigger deal. I mean, every institution, restaurants are thinking about infections acquired within their institution. So imagine being a hospital worrying about, a patient showing up with COVID and then that spreading within your hospital. That's a very scary thing to think about. And I know every hospital is thinking about that, in addition to even more infection-rich environments like nursing homes, where the whole point of a nursing home is the opposite of social distancing. It's to create community within the nursing home community. And, you know, how do you sort of adjust to that world where sometimes people don't have anywhere else to go to get the care? And, you know, so even for those sorts of patients, being able to build at-home models when they don't have a home to go to is, it you know, this is not a short-term fix. This is something that's going to take real restructuring. That's going to take time to sort of roll out. So for the next 12 months, I would imagine for the next, frankly, 60 months, the next 5 years, this is going to be retooling, reorganizing. Leadership teams are going to change. The way that hospitals think about their fixed cost infrastructure is going to change. Their investments in virtual models, telehealth, things like that is going to be increasing. And then they're building workflows around that is going to be, you know, it's going to take some time. And then I think, you know, but at the same time, we're still carrying on, you know, we're trying to do the things that, you know, we were doing pre-pandemic. That many of them do merge with the initiatives that hospitals are going to undergo to you know, outfit themselves for a post-COVID era. Things like virtual care, you know, more care being delivered in the home. You know, the continuing shift to value-based care. We heard Seema Verma really emphasize how important value-based care is in a post-COVID world. And so I think those will be, you know, one, I don't, you know, something of this scale, it's gonna reverberate and require retooling for a very long time. And then I think continuing to maintain business as usual, or at least try to get to some version of prior business in this new context, is going to be, you know, something that hospital executives are going to be dealing with for some time.
So this last question, I'm really going to tap into your CEO leadership and what you do. In my visit there to your headquarters pre-pandemic, you had an amazing culture you've created there. It's a fun place. You wouldn't say, okay, this company does ADT, you know, e-notification transfer. You go, okay, well, that's a pretty technical place. Except you've created a really neat culture around there of engagement with your team, people enjoying the workplace, really kind of that, for lack of a better term, cool environment that people want to serve and do something important. You know, you've had to distribute your team. How are you holding on to those threads of that great culture you've created to continue the good work you're doing?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, Russ. We do take our you know, I don't think you can have a productive organization or, you know, impact in the market without a team that's motivated and excited and feels supported in their efforts to, you know, to execute on the mission. So I think number one is, you know, the mission. I think, you know, when the work you're doing can clearly track to good things happening for your community, your friends, your family, your loved ones, that you can see that if they were in the hospital, you'd want their primary care doctor to be able to support their care transition so that they get the best care. And if you think about it, you know, patients who are frail and elderly or, you know, experiencing, you know, in, you know, sort of chronic loneliness, because there's a real pandemic around loneliness, you know, it's a lot easier to lead an organization that, you know, feels very motivated about the mission. It's not about me. It's not about, you know, patient pain. It's really about the work that we're doing for the patients and the providers that are impacted by our work. So I always point as much as possible to that. And, you know, and I think even in our work that when we're selling into a customer or when we're advocating for something with CMS, you know, to be passionate about it, to advocate very, very firmly and fiercely for it, when it feels for me or for the company, it's really hard to be very, very sort of authentic and passionate about it. But when you don't feel like you're doing it for yourself, or you don't feel like you're doing it for the company, you feel like you're doing it for the patients and the providers that you're representing, it's very easy to be loud and consistent and persistent about it, because it's for the greater good. And so we really try to you know, I try to lead with sort of why leadership and why this is important for the people, well beyond, you know, our four walls. So that's one. And two is, I think, you know, it's a set of values that binds a group together. You know, I think, you know, we have five values: grit, rigor, ownership, authenticity, humility, that we try to embed deeply within our organization. You know, we provide a lot of transparency. Without transparency, you can't have ownership, and we want people to feel ownership for their work and see how it connects into the vision and mission of what we're doing. And we always kind of come back to those values when we're thinking about, why is somebody not swimming in the same direction as somebody else on the team, or when there's interpersonal friction, or when there's things that aren't working. You know, I think when you have a consistent set of values that we want our team members to exhibit, I think you can, you know, so you combine both a set of values for how we behave, pointed towards the mission that we're all motivated about, and you get some really wonderful things to happen.
Well, Jay, I will just say on a personal basis, it's been great to get to know you over the last year, but on a professional basis, most importantly, thank you for everything you're doing for our CHIME members, for healthcare in general, across an entire country. I know you truly care about doing this for the right reasons, which is truly patient care and improving outcomes. So on behalf of that, thank you for everything you do, and thanks for being on the program today.
I appreciate that, Russ. Thank you so much for what you do and your leadership in the healthcare community and in broadly the CIO ecosystem, and everything that you do for groups like ours. So really, really do appreciate your work. It's very important work, and we're really privileged to be a part of it.
So thank you again, and thank you to our listeners out there. If you need a little help with this ADT requirement coming up early next year, feel free to give Jay a call. I won't get his personal cell phone out right now, but he's pretty easy to get a hold of. And so again, we'd also like to thank you for listening to this episode of our Digital Health Leaders podcast. As always, you can find this episode on Spotify or Apple, or our website at chimecentral.org/media for all of our programming. For now, take care, stay safe. If you leave your home, wear your mask, and God bless.